Good evening and welcome behind the news for March 17, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two interviews up for tonight. First, with a frequent guest on this show, Anatole Levin, commenting about the great enthusiasm that many people, including John Stewart, from whom one expects better, about the prospects for democracy and all that in the Middle East. Maureen Dowd writing that George Bush is in a kind of jaunty and upbeat mood ever since the Iraqi elections, really full of himself. And, well, we'll see if that chest puffing and such is well earned, at least from Anatole Levin's perspective. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded earlier this week with the Fordham University Law School professor Jennifer Gordon, who has a book out called Suburban Sweatshops. And she spent many years in the 90s organizing immigrant workers on Long Island. And we'll talk to her about that at the bottom of the hour. Then, first of all, though, some news headlines. Amazingly, the George Bush has nominated Paul Wolfowitz to head the World Bank. Wolfowitz, of course, notable as the leading architect of the war in Iraq, and also for sticking his comb in his mouth before combing his hair in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. But Wolfowitz has absolutely no background in economics or finance or development or anything like that. He is just a pure imperial hound. Interesting that he would name Wolfowitz, sort of Germanized version of the Russian suffix indicating son of, will be succeeding if he gets the approval of the rest of the world, which seems likely at this point, will be succeeding James Wolfensohn, German for son of a wolf. So one son of a wolf succeeding another at the World Bank, it seems. Some people have rather carelessly been throwing around the word neoliberal to describe Wolfowitz and the Bush administration. I think that's not true. They really are neoconservatives, and the difference is that, if we look at Wolfensohn's resume, before he came to the World Bank, he was an investment banker, came out of the world of finance, loves markets, loves freely floating prices and all that. Wolfowitz, however, coming out of the neoconservative corner of the American political spectrum, doesn't think so much about markets. He's much more of a state power kind of guy, very aware that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. The Bush administration really never showing much interest in economics conventionally or narrowly defined, much more interested in political and military power. And that seems to be what Wolfowitz's mission would be should he go to the World Bank. The United States has about 16.4%, rounding off, I think a couple of decimal points, 16-some percent of the vote at the World Bank. The rest of the world has 84%. So they could theoretically band together and easily block the nomination. But the United States has traditionally chosen the president of the World Bank, who has always been an American, the head of the IMF, a managing director, a very European title, as opposed to president, which is a very American title. Managing director of the IMF has always been a European, and some pressure to change that, but it hasn't changed yet. The United States objected to Europe's first choice for the head of the IMF back in 2000, and that nomination was blocked. So there is some precedent for blocking the nomination of a preferred candidate. But, of course, Europe is not the same as the United States. And from the looks of things right now, unless the French and Germans put up a big fight, it will be Wolfowitz at the World Bank. A real message of flipping the bird to the rest of the world, totally consistent with everything else the Bush administration has done. Still, fairly stunning, actually. And then in some of the economic indicator news, this morning's report on weekly jobless claims, a number of people who lost their jobs and headed over to the unemployment insurance office last week to sign up for benefits. That fell by 10,000 after a surprising rise the previous week, and the four-week moving average, which is what people follow to smooth out the week-to-week volatility, rose slightly, but that rising trend seems to have been nipped in the bud, at least for now. So a fairly healthy look, at least to this number. Sign that fewer people are losing their jobs than were even a year ago. But again, the pace of hiring has not been picking up as much as it should. So even though the job loss is down, job gains may not so be great, may not be so great. So we'll have to see what next month's employment report looks like. But the one that came out a couple of weeks ago for February showed gains, but not spectacular gains. ABC Washington Post weekly measure of consumer attitudes, that off a point last week to about an average reading by this index's history. So people are not exactly enthusiastic. They're not exactly pessimistic either. So, but they are buying things, it seems. Retail sales released earlier this week for February gained a half a percentage point in the month of February, following on gains of 0.3% and 1.3%. So a string of fairly solid gains in retail sales. And a little weakness in auto sales last month after a strong January. But people are buying things, and it's not because the labor market has been so strong. It's because they've been borrowing lots of money, and they've been borrowing lots of money against their house values, as we've been talking about here for weeks and weeks and weeks. And all that buying without as much production or job generation as we would hope for has been resulting in a serious deterioration of the U.S. foreign accounts. That is, U.S. trade balance for January in the red by a tune of $100 billion, an increase of a considerable amount. Oh, sorry, that's exports. I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong number here. U.S. international trade deficit rose to $58 billion in January, up about $3 billion from the previous month, even though oil prices were down, which should have helped things. So the underlying trend is still very poor. We're importing a lot more than we're exporting. And this continues to be a very serious problem for the United States economy. We continue to need massive amounts of foreign finance. There are signs that foreigners are being less indulgent, particularly the Asian central banks, but this hasn't come to a crunch yet. We shall see if that happens. But the U.S. Festival of Consumption, which by historical standards is very, very high, even though the economy isn't so great, has been financed by money coming from Asian central banks, and it just doesn't seem like something that's very sustainable. It looks like the United States will have to tighten its belt considerably in the coming months and years, but no signs of that yet happening. And Argentina, though, showing a very strong year last year, with GDP growing by almost 10%, almost Chinese rates of growth in Argentina, despite, well, maybe because of defaulting on their bonds, a course that should be recommended to many countries, it seems. And more of that in the near future. It's a great story, and I should look at that a little more closely. Let's take a little musical break and then come back with Anatole Levin. Thank you. And that was a little bit from Maurizio Pollini playing Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 31, a bit from the third movement. And we're back, and we have Anatole Levin on the line. Welcome to Behind the News, Anatole Levin.
Hello.
So, first of all, before we get to the main reason I ask you to join us, what do you make of the Wolfowitz nomination at the World Bank?
Well, it gets him out of the Defense Department, which I think is a good thing. But on the other hand, it is a really gross slap in the face to the international community, to Europe, to the development community, to the developing world, to the international banking community. Because it's not just that, as has been pointed out, you know, he's such a controversial figure internationally, but he has virtually no serious experience in the world of banking or indeed of development. So to appoint him after somebody like Wolfensohn is, I mean, clearly just a sign that America or the Bush administration intends to turn the World Bank into an instrument of American policy.
Well, it has been a bit of that, hasn't it, all along? I mean, Wolfensohn, you know, was certainly no enemy of American policy.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, but, well, to some extent you could say that there was a decent veil drawn over this, which has now been removed. But in the context of the war on terror and of relations with countries like Iran, this could be of new importance if there is a really crude attempt to turn the bank, you know, simply into an instrument of American wishes.
So there have been some noises of disapproval coming out of Western Europe, but the consensus seems to be right now that Wolfowitz is going to get through, even though everyone else has 84% of the votes in the World Bank. Why do you think that they're going to be rolling over for this one as it looks right now?
Well, you know, it is the conventional tradition that America chooses the head of the World Bank, but in the past, you know, American administrations have always been careful to pick candidates who, you know, would enjoy a wider legitimacy and support. The Europeans, of course, have done the same in picking the head of the IMF. I mean, they have been accorded essentially that right by Washington, but they've been careful to pick candidates who would not be, regarded in Washington as grossly illegitimate. But I don't think that the Europeans, who are now very anxious, you know, to try and get on with the Bush administration, will want to risk what would be a really ferocious dust-up over this. But on the other hand, you know, no doubt they will be, in choosing the head of the IMF, they will be less responsive to American wishes in future.
And I imagine the staff of the World Bank can't be too happy to be working for Wolfowitz. He's not their kind of guy.
Well, from what I gather, they're very unhappy indeed. Partly, as I say, because this isn't just an insult to the international community. It is an insult to the bank. You know, in the past, people have been chosen who have enormous experience of international banking. Of course, Wolfowitz doesn't. None, as far as I know.
He was on the board of Hasbro, the toy maker, for a little while. That's his experience of international business so far.
Well, great.
where he knows something. I think they make G.I. Joe, so maybe he knows something about toy soldiers. Well, let's switch to the main topic here, which is the spreading enthusiasm over democracy in the Middle East. Even John Stewart, much to my disappointment, has been saying that maybe we have to concede that Bush had a point after all. So are you joining the party of converts now that the Iraqi elections proceeded successfully and the Cedar Revolution seems to be unfolding, though not without some bumps along the way in Lebanon, etc.?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I am not fixed in my opinions. And also, of course, I support democracy as a long-term goal. And so in 20 or 30 years, if indeed, you know, democracy has spread in the region, I shall be delighted to join the Bush camp or whatever it calls itself then. But it's too early by a generation to tell. After all, look at the Iraqi elections. Yes, they held elections, but they haven't yet been able even to choose a speaker of the parliament. You know, convening the parliament has been delayed literally by months. They can't form a government because there are extremely intractable issues between the different ethno-religious groups in that country. I mean, as to you know, the absolute fake facade of an election in Egypt and local elections in Saudi Arabia. I mean, don't you think this is a bit early to start talking about a democratic revolution? I mean, really? You know.
Well, I think Americans, or at least some of them, seem to think that democracy is just about elections and what happens afterwards is secondary.
Well, but that's exactly it. But, you know, look at the history of Russia in recent years. They had a very, very flawed democratic revolution in the 1990s, but which was accompanied by so much disorder, looting, corruption, and crime, that ever since then they've been going backwards, you know, to semi-authoritarianism. Perhaps they'll go to full authoritarianism, with, by the way, the overwhelming support of the Russian people, who turned against democracy with a capital D. You know, history is not a straight line in that way.
Well, for the Russians, democracy was associated with impoverishment and decay and decline.
Yeah. Well, you know, we may find that in Iraq, democracy becomes associated with civil war, massive corruption, if you've seen the latest report of, you know, Transparency International, organized crime and so forth and so on. My point is, it's, you know, it's far, far too early to tell. After all, in Latin America in recent years, people have been worrying precisely once again that in many areas democracy might be going backwards. Take Venezuela, for an example. So, you know, really this kind of media fashion. I think part of it is that the, you know, as with the acceptance of, or the probable acceptance of Wolfowitz's appointment, the Europeans are so anxious at the moment to get back on good terms with Washington that they are also going along with this. And also because, I mean, to be fair, we're all supporters of democracy as the ultimate goal. It's just a question of how you get there and how quickly.
Well, in a lot of parts of the Middle East, were there democratic governments, they would not be terribly friendly to the United States. They might nationalize their oil. They might impose some sort of theocratic law. Are the Bush people thinking that far, or they just think this is some sort of theater or that they could stage manage appropriately?
I think it's theater. I think, you know, they will accept very, very limited concessions from American allies like Egypt on this, while using the cry of democracy to put pressure on real or perceived American enemies like Iran and Syria. That seems to be the real truth of it. I would be astonished if you saw, for example, any real American pressure on the Jordanian monarchy. Because, of course, you know, if you had a democratic revolution in Jordan, it would be a Palestinian revolution, essentially, because a majority of the population are Palestinian. This would be extremely bad for American interests. It would be very bad for Israel. And so, you know, I simply think it's impossible that America would support anything of this kind. And the same goes, you know, for a range of other countries in the region as well. So I think, to a very great extent, this is window dressing, which is not to say, of course, that some of what's been happening has not been in itself positive, because, you know, any democratic change in Saudi Arabia is a good thing, of course.
Of course, the United States has done its best to prevent the democratic evolution of Saudi Arabia for much of the last 5 decades.
Well, you know, that's the other thing. You know, one does have to understand why so many Arabs and Muslims are intensely skeptical of American, you know, sincerity when it comes to this, because, you know, they just look at history. British too, by the way. I have to say, as a Brit, I mean the Brits look even make even the American record look respectable on that score. You know, and so when Tony Blair speaks in the region, people tend to laugh even louder than they do when Bush speaks. It's a long, long road ahead of us, and it's far too early to say what's going to happen. Well, even in Lebanon, for example, after all, Lebanon was a democracy, although a troubled one, for 30 years after the Second World War. And then it broke down in horrendous civil war in the 1970s. So it's just not true that there's no history of democracy in the Arab world. It's just that, you know, as in a number of countries, you had democracies which then collapsed again, or semi-democracies.
I'm speaking with Anatole Lieben, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington and author most recently of America, Right or Wrong, an Anatomy of American Nationalism, published by Oxford University Press. And you have a piece in today's Financial Times on Nathan Sharansky, who wrote a book that George Bush claims to have read and claims to have been influenced by. Tell us about Sharansky, his book, and his influence on Bush.
Well, you know, I pointed out in my review that, you know, Sharansky's profession of support for Palestinian democracy and of willingness to make, he said, any agreement with the Palestinians, if only they become a democracy, has been completely contradicted by his record and that of his party in government. I mean, most recently by his personal decision as Minister for Jerusalem. To allow the Israeli government to confiscate Palestinian land in the Jerusalem area, a decision struck down by Israel's Attorney General as illegal and contrary to international law. So, I mean, how one can genuinely believe that somebody like this, you know, has the genuine interests of Palestinian or Arab democracy at heart is completely beyond me. But, you know, it's not a question of what I think. It's what a question of most Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims think. And that's not to say that Sharansky wasn't an extremely brave Soviet dissident. But, you know, we know enough about former Soviet dissidents by now. You know, look at Solzhenitsyn, look at Gamsa Khurdia in Georgia or Elchebey in Azerbaijan, you know, to know that they came in two forms, one of which were genuine fighters for freedom, and the other were basically nationalist protesters against Soviet rule.
Yeah, you open with an anecdote about an Armenian that you met. Tell us about the Armenian.
Yeah, well, you know, he had struggled hard for Armenian democracy, but he was also absolutely committed, you know, to Armenian rule over part of Azerbaijan and to Armenian annexation of the whole of eastern Turkey, which is not a great contribution to peace, or would not be, if it happened, God forbid, a great contribution to peace or democracy in the region. So, I mean, he was a Democrat, certainly, but he was a Democrat for Armenia, not for anybody else.
And what is Sharansky's book like? It's very interesting to think of a book that actually captured George Bush's mind like this. So what kind of book captures George Bush's mind?
Oh, it's terrifying. I mean, it is terrifying. It is, you know, so utterly... well, I mean... To be perfectly honest, it's a Soviet work. It's a work of Soviet propaganda. I mean, utterly one-sided, shallow, extremist, but without any, you know, any connection to the guy's own record, let alone to observable reality. I mean, but possibly the most striking index of this is not actually what he writes about the Middle East, but the fact that while continually going on about how realists and liberals betrayed Soviet dissidents like himself and how one has to, you know, take up a position of absolute morality in politics, he rather ignores the fact that in recent years, Sharansky has made tremendous efforts to establish good relations with Vladimir Putin, of all people, you know, former KGB officer introducing authoritarianism into Russia. And Sharansky's been doing that for perfectly respectable realist reasons, you know, in terms of Israel's need for good relations with Russia and the need to, protect the remaining Russian Jews, which are perfectly respectable reasons. I'm not arguing against them at all, but they totally contradict the accusations and attacks he makes on everybody else when they pursue, such realist programs.
And what kind of insight does it give us into what George Bush means by his passionate crusade for democracy?
Well, I mean, I think all it shows, what it principally shows, is that Bush just has absolutely no understanding of the Middle East or of the impact on ordinary Arabs and Muslims of his actions or his words or, you know, perceptions of American policy, because, of course, from this point of view, Sharansky is a disaster. But, you know, this goes to the heart of the sort of almost Orwellian contradiction in Bush administration policy in the Middle East, which is that it combines a professed desire to spread democracy in the region with an absolute contempt for the opinions, the views, and the perceptions of people who, after all, are supposed to become democratic Arab and Muslim voters.
Well, don't they think that you're just the wrong kind of people? I mean, when you talk about Sharansky says he'd be happy to make a deal with the Palestinians if they understood democracy. There's something about, you know, that old Brecht comment about dissolving the people and electing another.
Well, absolutely. That's exactly it, yes. I mean, they would like a different, a different Palestinian and Arab population. And look, I mean, I'm not saying that in an ideal world that might not be a good thing, but you know, life doesn't work that way. You work with the Arab and the Muslim and the American and the European peoples that you have, not with ones that you would like to invent. From that point of view, I mean, once again, I do see Sharansky as a very, very Soviet figure.
Well, that sort of fits with the neocons. Well, they were they're Trotskyist temperaments.
So,
different brands of Soviet. What does it look like the second Bush administration is shaping up to be like to you? Is it pretty much the same as the first, or are they trying to appear a little more conciliatory? They're sending Condi around the world to be diplomatic. Is it substance, or is it appearance, or what do you make of it?
Well, there has always been a deep strain of pragmatism in parts of Bush administration policy. Good old, tough, realist pragmatism. I mean, look at their relations with China. They came in with a tremendously anti-Chinese program of isolating and containing China. And then even before 9/11, they basically realized that was just too dangerous.
And then Walmart would have nothing to sell.
Amongst other things, yes. And that then there would be no way of controlling North Korea. And that also just the threat of a conflict, which would bring the world economy down in ruins. And so, you know, obviously they haven't simply gone all the way to a Chinese position, naturally. But they've pursued very moderate and pragmatic policies towards China in recent years. One can also see that in relations with Vladimir Putin. Bush has criticized Putin over democracy, and he's certainly and quite rightly taken a very strong stand, you know, against Russian interference in Ukraine, say. But equally, Bush has resisted very strongly, you know, pushes from U.S. Congress, including from the Republicans there, to take a much tougher line against Putin personally. And he went off to Bratislava, and he negotiated a set of very pragmatic agreements on things like, you know, controls of Russian nuclear stocks. So there always has been this element of pragmatism, and I think you can now see this coming into a degree in behavior towards Iran and relations with Europe. But it certainly doesn't constitute any kind of philosophical change in their attitude to the outside world. They haven't been converted in any sense to genuine multilateralism. It's just that, you know, except for the crazier neocons, these people are on the whole pragmatic realists. And if they see, for example, that a war with Iran is just too dangerous, they will try to pursue, to a limited degree, other courses.
Well, they thought they could push it on Iraq, but even that hasn't worked out too well.
Well, no.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Anatol Levin.
It was a pleasure.
Anatol Levin is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington and author most recently of the book America, Right or Wrong, An Anatomy of American Nationalism, published by Oxford University Press. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Jennifer Gordon.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. The voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And I don't think my hero Iggy mentioned the web, which is WBAI.org. This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, and now we're entering the second half of the show. And now play a recording of an interview I did earlier this week with Jennifer Gordon, who is a professor of law now at Fordham University. She spent much of the 1990s organizing a workers' center, the Workplace Project on Long Island, trying to organize immigrant workers in what she calls suburban sweatshops. She won a MacArthur Genius Grant in the late 90s, and all around an extremely impressive person. So the book that she wrote is called Suburban Sweatshops, which just came out from Harvard University Press. So let's listen to the interview with Jennifer Gordon. Suburban sweatshops, of course, that doesn't fit our cliché image of what suburbs are like. So what's going on out there in the Levitt towns of America?
I think what happens is you say sweatshop and people think garment factory. It's an absolute association. And if you think about what a sweatshop is and you take apart its parts, it's very bad work, very long hours, very low wages, high risk of injury. And once you see it that way, you see sweatshops all over. And suburbia is one of the places where there's the greatest growth.
And the other surprising thing is the cliched image of Long Island is a place that was populated by white flight, to put it crudely. And the population of Long Island has gotten considerably more diverse since those cliches were generated. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, in fact, Long Island has a very rich history, a rich labor history, a rich ethnic history. And so I will say Long Island has changed, and it's changed particularly with regard to its immigrant population. But it always had African Americans. It always had some amount of new immigrants. And it always had some kind of labor organizing. And all those things are an interesting part of the mix. But with regard particularly to Latino immigrants, an enormous increase in Long Island, as also in other suburbs around the United States. And I think the latest estimate is about 300,000 Latinos living in Long Island. And what you see if you look at immigration patterns over the past 20 years is that they've shifted dramatically. Immigrants are not anymore going in the largest numbers to the big immigrant-receiving cities. Instead of Los Angeles, they're going to the suburbs around Los Angeles. Instead of New York, they're going to the suburbs around New York. Or they're going to the South and southeastern states. So you see things like in Atlanta, 817% increase in its foreign-born population between 1980 and 2000, a real shift in demographics around the country.
And in many places, this has provoked a nativist backlash, and Long Island was in the news for that. What's happened to that?
Well, starting in the late 1990s, many of the people listening will be familiar with the story of how two immigrant laborers on a day labor corner were attacked, and actually there was an attempted murder of them by two men, skinheads, who were later convicted for trying to kill them. And sadly, that wasn't the end of the matter. A surge of racist anti-immigrant sentiment led by a group with ties to national xenophobic immigrant-hating groups. There have been firebombings, anti-immigrant demonstrations, really a terrible situation.
Employers have frequently brought in immigrants to lower wages, so there is this material basis for what turns out to be rather ugly racist displays. How can you think about these things? How do you balance this sense of looking at immigrant workers as threatening a standard of living against cosmopolitanism and decency and tolerance?
Well, I think the first thing to realize when you're thinking about that question is if you don't fight with immigrants for basic workplace rights for them, you're ceding the ground, right? Like the fight to defend immigrants' basic rights, the right to minimum wage, the right to decent treatment on the job, is first of all, by me, it's a fight for human decency and dignity, and you support it because of that. But it's also a fight to create a floor in terms of wages. And if you don't stand with immigrants for those basic rights, you end up with no floor at all on how people can be treated.
Let's talk more specifically about the kinds of workers you're working with and your workplace project. First of all, what industries, what sectors are these suburban sweatshops that you are working with?
Really in service work. So what you see are restaurants, small restaurants, the busboys and the dishwashers working 70, 75 hours a week, getting $2.50, $3 an hour. Landscapers. Landscapers don't get promised less than minimum wage. Almost universally, they're promised more than minimum wage. Their problems are twofold. They don't get paid. That is, they'll go through a month or 6 weeks of work and their employer will say, oop, sorry, the money didn't come in. You're not going to get paid for that work. Or sometimes and they get badly injured on the job. And that's sort of hard. You know, you think of landscaping as your kid mows the lawn, right? Or your kid mows the lawn for a summer and gets paid. But if you think of landscaping or lawn mowing as a sweatshop industry, what that means is these guys are mowing 40, 50, 60 lawns a day. So like in any sweatshop, speed is of the essence. And so employers will remove guards from lawnmowers. And if there's a clog, they'll tell the worker to keep the machine running while they free it. And so what you see among men who have a long history of landscaping is they're missing digits of their fingers because their fingers get cut off when the blades start to spin and the clog is freed. That plus back injuries and unsafe chemicals, those are the kind of hazards in landscaping. You see a lot of domestic workers at the very low end of the market who are paid $200 for a week of work, maybe 80 hours in that week. So a lot of service industries. Also at the low end, janitorial work, construction work at the low end, the whole range of service work.
So how do you approach organizing a population that's so diverse, so spread out, that is in many senses socially or even physically invisible to the outside world? What's the approach?
One approach is a worker center approach, and I think I'll talk about that in a second, but I think the challenges you mentioned are one reason why unions have really struggled with these lowest wage workers, workers in the underground economy, or, you know, or sort of the half under and half above ground economy.
Yeah, this is the very opposite of like the Ford Rouge plant, which is, you know, continental in its scale.
Right, exactly. It's not out there, although actually I think it's frankly very visible if you want to look for it, but it's not one big location. It's small numbers of workers scattered all over the place, and that is a real challenge for the standard union organizing model. Add to that that a number of these workers are undocumented. Add to that their vulnerability and their urgent need for work, and you have a nightmare for the standard union organizing model. So worker centers, as I mentioned, are a fairly new phenomenon, which are an attempt to work with immigrants themselves as leaders to take on some of the worst working conditions in the underground economy. And one of their features is they often work across industries because you don't have in Long Island, it would be very rare to have, an immigrant man who said, I am a landscape worker. I have always worked in landscape. Instead, you do a few months in landscape. The season ends. You go into a restaurant. You may have a part-time janitor job to complement that. Then you lose those jobs and you're in a factory for a while. Working across industry allows the workers to stay with the organization even as they change jobs. Another feature of worker centers is they offer services, and think of services as a bridge to organizing. So the Workplace Project, when I was there, had a legal clinic that helped immigrant workers solve their unpaid wages problems. And it now continues to do that in a sort of workshop way where immigrant workers support each other. Worker centers do a lot of education, popular education.
A lot of immigrant workers think of them here themselves as just here temporarily. They pick up some money before they go home. Their hearts may be with their family and friends at home. How do you deal with that?
I think that you're absolutely right that most people come with the idea that they're going to be here a short time and return home. And I think there's a turning point when people realize they thought it was going to be 2 years, and it's been three, it's been four, it's been seven, it's been 15, and they're not going home, and they haven't been able to earn the money that in their fantasies they could have. And I think groups like worker centers play an important role in getting people to stop and think. You know, you may not be here forever, but while you're here, how are you being treated? Does that comport with your sense of who you are as a human being and your dignity? And is it worth it to take some time and take some risks to stand up for your rights?
I'm speaking with Jennifer Gordon, author of Suburban Sweatshops, just out from Harvard University Press. How did someone find her way from the Harvard Law School to organizing immigrant workers in Long Island?
Harvard Law School was actually a detour, I think. I had been working with Central American immigrants before I went to law school, right around the time that employer sanctions were passed. So all of a sudden, for the first time in our country's history, it became illegal for an employer to hire an undocumented worker. And it was the work that I did both with workers and with employers at that time, educating the employers about how they could keep immigration out of their workplaces, educating the workers about how to defend themselves if there was an immigration raid, that the idea of starting a center for immigrant workers who were largely outside unions, who were being ignored by government enforcement, that I started to think about that. And then I went to law school, and it was when I was in my second year of law school that I started to raise money to start the Workplace Project. So law school has been hugely helpful, but it came in the middle of a flow of work in that area.
Let's step out of the main topic here just to ask a broader policy question. There seems to be a contradiction at the heart of our attitude and policy towards immigrants. The economy, in some sense, would grind to a halt without them. Businesses want low-wage workers. Rich people want nannies and gardeners. At the same time, there's this attempt to police the borders and punish people who violate immigration laws. What is the sense behind all that, or is it as contradictory as it looks in the face?
Well, I actually think it's quite a coherent system. It's just it would sound so ugly if the President of the United States were to stand up and say what that system is. You know, the system is there are only so many people politically that we can let in legally to the United States without generating a backlash. And yet we acknowledge that we need their work. So we're going to make it very difficult to come but not impossible and not really enforce minimum wage laws and other protective laws so that we do create, while we condemn this vulnerable low-wage workforce, and yet we keep the barriers high to really becoming a full citizen in the United States. It's ugly. It has a certain coherence, nonetheless.
So it makes sense from the boss's point of view to have this scared population, uncertain status, who'll do anything to go along?
Oh, yes. And, in fact, it's the Wall Street Journal that's been the strongest advocate for open borders. Of all of the major newspapers, they regularly, around July 4th, published their open borders editorial. They took a brief hiatus after 9/11, but they've republished it since. And massive undocumented immigration serves business interests, a number of business interests, although not all of them.
Let's talk about the Workplace Project itself. How did it get started? What was the strategy? And what's happening with it now?
I started the Workplace Project in 92. Actually, all I started doing with the help of CORESAN, a Central American refugee center in Hempstead, was offering help to immigrant workers who hadn't been paid minimum wage or who hadn't been paid anything at all, frankly. And out of that and some classes that I started giving about labor history and labor rights and immigration in the United States, came a group of immigrant workers who were committed to founding an independent worker center. The first organizer who worked with me, a Salvadoran man named Omar Enriquez, he and I and this group of workers, a couple years after I had started this clinic, founded the Workplace Project as an independent member-based worker center, really with two levels of organizing strategy. One is, of course, what you think of when you say organizing, which is how you take on bad wages and bad working conditions. The other, though, and just as important, is the strategy for building a genuine immigrant-led organization. And so a lot of thought at the Workplace Project has gone into how you bring immigrant workers in, invite them into the organization, how you build their capacity to lead in the organization and organizing efforts, building a board that comes entirely out of the membership and so on. And so I was at the Workplace Project for 6 years. I left in 98. It's been run pretty much since then by Nadia Marin Molina, who's the current director, who's done an amazing job in the face of, as we were discussing, the real surge in anti-immigrant sentiment on Long Island, yes, in the late 90s and early in this decade.
So tell us some stories of the workers you started trying to organize. For example, like day laborers standing on a street corner. What's the approach to organizing them? What are the issues? What's the strategy? What's the sales pitch?
Well, the first thing that happened with day laborers, and this was in 1994, was that a group of day laborers who we were working with, which is in what really is the most common organizing approach to day laborers, just to defend their right to ask for work, to work out a place that they and the city and contractors could all agree they could stand. This was in Inwood. those workers started to talk about setting a minimum wage for that street corner where they were waiting. People were going for around $45 a day, and they wanted $60. And then people started talking, and they said, well, look, if we set it at $60, they'll just go up the road to the Franklin Square workers' day labor corner, or to Freeport, or to Westbury, or, you know, any of the other ones in Nassau County. And that's when we realized you can't do it just on one corner. You have to have committees on all the corners. And so Omar went around to all the corners, invited the workers to a big meeting. Each corner that I've mentioned formed its own committee. They all got together. They all decided on $60 a day. They all went back to their corners and then began the hard work, really, for 3 years of making that minimum wage set by nobody but the workers, right? Certainly not set by the government, making that real. And that is the most brute kind of organizing. You know, you're on a corner. There are 100 guys on the corner. They know on a good day only 30 of them will get jobs. A truck rolls up. The truck says $55, and 100 men who need work have to say, no, I won't go. No union structure, you know, no beautiful hiring hall, no strike wages, nothing. They just have to watch that truck pull away. And for a while, the Workplace Project and those workers' committees were able to enforce that minimum wage. And that was extraordinary to see, you know, literally to see workers watch a truck pull away because they would not break their own minimum wage.
You said for a while. Did it fall apart?
It fell apart in small ways and then eventually entirely. In small ways in the sense that as every morning goes on and then as every season, you know, as the good weather period goes on, you know, later in the day, jobs are scarcer. People will go for less. Later in the season, fall is coming. People will go for less. That the committees were able to live with. But come 96, with a real surge nationally in anti-immigrant sentiment, with a crackdown on immigrants, the workers were just too anxious to hold to that minimum wage. People wanted to earn whatever money they could. And the Workplace Project, as a democratic organization, respected that and decided that it was, you know, it was going to continue to work with day laborers, but not itself certainly enforce any kind of minimum wage that the workers themselves didn't want. At the same time, the economy had gotten a little better, you know, and the $60 no longer seemed like such a stretch, you know, and that as a minimum certainly holds on most street corners now.
What about domestics? How do you go about organizing them?
Domestic workers in the United States have a long history of trying to organize. African-American women, particularly a little after the turn of the century, again in the 70s, have tried to organize and sometimes for a time succeeded. But it's the hardest group of workers to organize because you have one worker and one employer in every workplace, right? You know, the basic concept of organizing is that there's power in numbers. There are no numbers, you know, unless you're living in upstairs, downstairs. There are no numbers if you are the domestic worker for one family. And so the challenge is to figure out what kind of leverage you can have. One sort of leverage is going for people who want to do right by their workers and setting some standards that they can adhere to. And the Workplace Project did some of that. But another one is working with agencies, placement agencies, because that's where employers in numbers meet with workers in numbers. And the Workplace Project carried out a campaign, another version of which was later carried out by Domestic Workers United in New York City, to set basic rights for domestic workers and to pressure agencies, you know, through protests and the media and phone calls and so on, to adhere to those minimum rights. And so the Workplace Project got a group of agencies in Long Island to agree to its Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. Later, Domestic Workers United in New York City got the city council to pass a bill requiring a basic contract for domestic workers when they were placed through agencies.
What are the possibilities for some kind of hiring hall arrangement or temp firms or worker co-ops, some way to formalize these presently informal relationships?
The Workplace Project has started two cooperatively owned businesses. One, CLIP, the Cooperative Landscaping Innovation Project, its business card said, a revolution in landscaping. It started in the late 90s and is now an independent business. And it still runs the Unity Cooperative, which is a women's cooperative that does home and business cleaning. And so, you know, on a very small scale, the organization has done cooperatively owned businesses and experimented with them. Those are fairly rare in the United States, although they're much more common in other countries. hiring halls are a real challenge in the sense that there's some things that work well about a day labor street corner. You know, precarious as it is, it gets workers where they're needed, and it gets gives homeowners a place to hire workers, and contractors a place, and workers who otherwise wouldn't have access to work a place where they can get jobs. And the difficulty is, if you formalize a street corner too much, set up a really rigid hiring hall with a lottery system or rules, what you find is you have another day labor street corner at the 7-Eleven around the corner where people are avoiding the formal one and recreating something informal. And so the real challenge, I think, with day labor organizing is to make it work for everybody who benefits from it while removing its abusive side.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Gordon, author of Suburban Sweatshops, just out from Harvard University Press. What about the role of law and lawyers in all this? Sometimes it runs the risk, I would imagine, of devolving into a legalistic, litigation-oriented approach rather than organizing people. How do you deal with the poles of that spectrum?
There's certainly a tension in the sense that if what you're doing, you're offering legal support to people to help them resolve, unpaid wages problems or minimum wage problems, that in itself is not going to lead to organizing. Just because people come in because they've had that problem doesn't mean they're going to stay to organize. And if a lawyer can solve their problem, then the question of why they should organize, much higher risk, much longer term, much more uncertain payoff, is a real question. Of course, a lawyer can't solve their problem. And that's, in a sense, how the tension gets resolved. A lawyer may be able to get, in fact, in my experience, almost always is able to get a victory in court. But a lawyer can't get that victory enforced. The Workplace Project has found that really the only enforcement tool available to workers is protesting, literally putting up a picket outside an employer's home where you parade the judgment around until the employer agrees.
Not a common suburban sight, right?
No, not at all. Not your typical suburban scene. But the trick or the challenge for the Workplace Project has been to figure out how talking to people about their rights can be something that is a first stage in an organizing process instead of something that shuts people down with a feeling like, well, those may be my rights, but there's no way I'm going to be able to get them. And simultaneously, how working either with a lawyer or with another group of workers to get legal rights respected can become the first step in an organizing process rather than a sort of dead end where people throw up their hands in desperation.
What were the relations like between the Workers' Center, the Workplace Project, and unions?
Varied tremendously by the union. In a number of instances, the Workplace Project carried out joint campaigns with unions, or really, I should say, worked with a union as its kind of immigrant connection arm so that the immigrants would come to the Workplace Project for meetings, but the meetings were about organizing into a particular union. Did that a couple times with CWA and once or twice with the United Food and Commercial Workers. Efforts to use what the Workplace Project had in terms of relationships with the community to build a bridge to union organizing. Other times when workers came in with unions that were corrupt or not responsive to them, there was more conflict between the project and unions, and the project would end up supporting workers who wanted to run different candidates for shop stewards, say, or organize, help those workers organize for a more responsive and more respectful union in their workplace.
And you say that this really can't be a model in the sense that it's so rooted in particular circumstances. But are there lessons to be learned for reversing this sad decline of American unionism here?
I think that worker centers are not themselves – not only are they not a model, but they're not themselves going to solve the problem of sweatshops. But I do think they have important things to offer to unions. One is the lesson that there's no such thing as an unorganizable worker. And worker centers, as well as the Workplace Project, are really developing immigrant worker leadership among people who our inclination might be to write off as unorganizable. Another lesson is – that you can win victories in situations that look desperate. Tremendously moving and important victory just a few days ago, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a worker center in Immokalee, Florida, after a three-year campaign, got Taco Bell to agree to increase what it pays for tomatoes, 1 cent a pound, and have that amount passed through directly to the workers, which given how much tomatoes workers pick in a day will mean a real wage increase. And also, Taco Bell agreed to put pressure on others in the industry to raise their standards. That was a long and hard-fought campaign, and the result is something that will directly increase workers' wages. I think the techniques that worker centers are using and their commitment to building a base in the immigrant community are showing that you can win what look like unwinnable battles. And the commitment to both that base building and taking the time it takes to figure out where you can win those kind of victories, I think, are hugely important lessons.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer Gordon. A very inspiring story.
Thank you.
And that was Jennifer Gordon, a professor of law at Fordham University and founder of the Workplace Project on Long Island, where she helped organize immigrant workers at a worker center there. The book, Suburban Sweatshops, just published by Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I guess I should go out and celebrate St. Patrick's Day by drinking a lot of green beer and then throwing up in the sidewalk. So I should sign off and leave you with this additional bit from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32, performed by Maurizio Pollini. I'll be back next week. Bye.